This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoy. And in our Race for the First series, we are sitting down with the candidates running in New Hampshire's 1st Congressional District. It is a crowded race, and we want to give each candidate some time to explain his or her positions on the issues. And we want you to ask questions, too. So give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Today, we are talking with Democrat Levy Sanders. The Claremont resident says it is time for Medicare for all, tuition-free college, a higher minimum wage, equal pay for women, and sensible gun legislation. He's also the son of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. We will talk with him about these issues today. Again, call now with your questions, 1-800-892-6477. So let's talk about Medicare for all. It's a concept many voters are familiar with because of your father's presidential campaign here in New Hampshire. He did very well here. How would you pay and execute a Medicare for all program?
Well, let me start off by saying I'm a fourth cousin of Larry David. That's the most important thing we ought to understand, okay? So that's where my sense of humor comes from.
Okay.
You know, the most important thing in terms of a Medicare for all, tuition-free, when you do a Medicare for all, we need to look and address this issue that we need the rich to pay their fair share of taxes. So I can talk, you know, in depth, but essentially that's basically what we need to do. We have three people right now that own more wealth than the bottom half of America. That is simply unacceptable. So when we look in terms of how little the rich are paying, I assure you ultimately that we can definitely pay for a Medicare for all. We are the wealthiest country in the world. We can guarantee health care to everybody without out-of-pocket expenses.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think of the Affordable Care Act? Did that work out, or is this sort of a natural progression from the Affordable Care Act?
The Affordable Care Act did a pretty good job, but the problem ultimately is, as I talk to and listen to folks in District 1, what they tell me is that the co-payments, the deductibles, and the premiums are way, way too high. People have profound levels of anxiety actually going into the doctor's office. And God forbid, if somebody gets hit by a bus, they don't know where they're going to pay for it. It's just unbelievable that you have a situation that you have deductibles. That when I talk to my cousin in England, he can't even understand the term of a deductible. So what I can tell you ultimately is that in this day and age, it's absolutely imperative that everybody has health care.
So if we do get Medicare for all as you envision it, what do you imagine happening with Department of Veterans Affairs, medical centers, and hospitals? What would become of those under this plan?
Well, right now, it's interesting. If you look at the Veterans Administration, it would be construed as ultimately in terms of democratic socialism. If you look at the way in which the VA, basically the bottom line is, when a veteran or somebody comes in, they should get the best health care that they can. They have fought. They come back in terms of sometimes with missing limbs, PTSD, and a whole host of other issues that occur. So I think ultimately that we can bring everybody together into the system and we can integrate it.
Okay. You also advocate for free college tuition. Is it safe to say that it would work the same way by taxing the super wealthy in order to pay for this program?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, the point is, and when you deal with tuition-free colleges and universities, again, when I talk, I talk to the this young man, I asked him about tuition-free colleges and universities, and he said, yes, absolutely. He goes, I don't want to pay any more tuition. I'm literally going to come. I'm going to be like $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 in debt. And simply put, that is not acceptable. Coupled with the fact that right now, when you have people paying, you know, ridiculous amounts in terms of their college loans, we should be able to do this at 2 or 3%, what you and I buy a car for, or in terms of or what we buy a house for.
Interest rates, you mean?
Absolutely, interest rates. Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
And would free college tuition apply across the board and not be income sensitive, or would those students who are well off be required to pay something?
Well, that's a really great question you ask, because one of the questions that people ask is, well, do you think Donald Trump's son or daughter should be able to pay it? First of all, Donald Trump or son have no desire whatsoever to go to a public school. That's the first issue. But yes, I do definitely think. I think that, you know, the reality is it somebody who ultimately is a millionaire, or even, you know, making, say, $500,000 a year, I think that's profoundly problematic. So I definitely think it should be somebody, you know, no more than, say, $200,000 a year.
Okay. Switching gears to the raise in the minimum wage, because you've proposed raising it to $15 an hour. What do you feel is the best way to do that?
Well, the first thing I want to just tell you about why, when I talk to folks in District 1, and I can give you an example. I was talking to this one woman who works in a small business. And I talked to her about the concept of a $15, and she couldn't even comprehend it. She's like, of course, but I'm making $7.25 an hour. So the point is, we have to get people to believe that they're actually entitled to it, right? So the point is, and we have to articulate to people that it's not going to hurt small businesses in terms of, right? The point is basically, when more people have more money in their pocket, they're more apt to help out the economy. So that's kind of my thoughts. But
yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, so the question was, how would you go about implementing that? Is it going to be an immediate thing, legislation that would jump it from, you know, basically 7.25 to 15, or is it a gradual thing to allow businesses to sort of ease into it?
Good. So, I mean, obviously, as you know, in New Hampshire, we said it's $7.25 an hour. You know, for when you talk to folks, in terms of federal, it just depends. But yes, you know, the reality is, obviously, is that this is something that has to be talked at, and discussed amongst a lot of people. But I think ultimately we need to get to a $15 minimum wage. So the point is we're going to have a very serious and substantive discussion with small businesses and get a better understanding from their perspective. We definitely have to do that fairly soon, though.
We're getting good questions from listeners. And listeners, if you have a question, send us an email or give us a call. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We got a question from Alex in Portsmouth who asks, do you believe President Trump should be impeached? Would you have voted with the roughly 60 progressive members of the Democratic caucus a few weeks ago to vote for impeachment on the floor?
Alex, that's a really great question. And what I would say to you right now is, unfortunately, the American public are not there yet. Do I feel ultimately that it can be proven that Donald Trump has engaged in impeachable offenses? Absolutely. And what we need to do is we need to continue to chip away at that theme and continue to do exactly what's going on right now in terms of holding the Trump administration accountable in terms of all the outrageous things that they've been doing. So again, I'm definitely willing to consider it, but right now we're just not there yet.
Jonathan wrote in to ask, in the name of safety and security for our children, do you support repealing the Second Amendment?
No, I don't. The Second Amendment is sacrosanct. I've talked to a lot of folks who are, and this is a really great question. People have legitimate anxiety and fear about taking away their guns. I'm going to give you just a quick example about this. I talked to somebody who works in terms of a tire warehouse, and I was talking. I said, "What is the number one issue that is concerned to you?" And they said, "Their guns." And I said, "But Barack Obama was there for 8 years. I never took away your guns and/or your ammunition and your bullets." And he said, "But I still have that level of anxiety." So we're gonna have to have a very serious and substantive discussion on this. But ensure ultimately that we have background checks. I don't think an AR-15, that folks should be able to have an AR-15. That's designed for the battlefield. We need to deal with a whole host of other issues. But the biggest issue we need to do is we need to talk to the really incredible gun owners, law-abiding gun owners that have very serious and substantive concerns about the real fear that they are going, that their gun is going to be taken away.
Mm-hmm. This is so. Is that what you meant when you say sensible gun legislation is necessary, taking away or banning AR-15s?
Yes.
And background checks.
Yes, absolutely. As well as addressing the issue of the gun show loophole.
The gun show loophole as
yep,
well. Okay. Anything else on sensible gun legislation that you would like to add?
The most important thing basically is just in relation to teachers. You know, teachers should not be carry a gun. They should be teaching. So again, that's it. But I'm gonna talk more in a substantive level. But I know we only have a few minutes. So.
Yeah, it's certainly a big subject to address. But we do want to talk about one thing that's really impacting the state, and that's the opioid crisis.
Yep.
New Hampshire's in line to receive some federal money to
yep.
fight it here.
Yep.
How do you think that money is best spent?
Well, first of all, not only do we have an opioid issue, we have a very serious alcohol problem. We probably have the worst alcohol problem in the country, which isn't even being dealt with. But what we need to do ultimately is we don't have enough counseling. We don't have enough substance abusers. So we need to bring a lot more people into the equation and talk about the issue. But we definitively have to have a lot more substance abuse, addiction centers. I mean, it's an unbelievable scenario. We need to basically encourage people to talk about what's going on in terms of why they're feeling that way. I mean, that's just a huge issue that we really need to address. And the issue ultimately in terms of the safe station, in Manchester, it's really a great program. People who have addiction issues, they can come in and get help. We need to have more, more stations that are available for folks like that.
Mm-hmm. And as Congressman, what would you do to further the fight against the opioid epidemic?
Wow. The most important thing that we need to have very, very serious substantive discussions. We have to have town halls. We need to bring the best people in the country on this issue. We need to bring low-income and working-class people and homeless people and talk about this issue, why it is they're feeling this way, and why are they engaging in this activity. New Hampshire is an incredibly beautiful state, and actually, financially, it does pretty well. Economically, it's doing well. But for whatever reason, people are having very serious problems, and they're engaging in this type of behavior, and we need to address that.
You mentioned alcohol being a serious problem. That's not something I've heard from the other candidates in this race so far. Why is that important to you?
Wow, because it's having profound and significant effects on the young people. This affects a variety of people. It affects employers. We know ultimately that, a lot of employers, in terms of both the issue of the opiate addiction as well as the alcohol problem, that this affects their people's ability to both get jobs, but all as well as employers to be able to have people to keep their jobs and to get good folks into the equation. But also, I'm there because it's having very physical and psychological effects on so many young people. We need to address this. We need to understand why people are feel the need to engage in that type of self-destructive behavior to the point that it affects their liver as well as has serious psychological.
So do you feel like there's some kind of legislation that you would need to co-sponsor or author as a congressman to address the problem of alcohol?
Well, again, obviously it's a situation, alcohol, as you know, is legal. But what we need to do is we need to provide more counseling centers and have people talk about those issues. So again, my point is basically we need to have a lot more counseling, a lot more discussion about why people are feeling that way and address those issues. And another issue ultimately, again, back to the point, is when you raise the $15 minimum wage, when you deal with tuition-free colleges and universities, when you deal with Medicare for all, people are not going to have that anxiety and that fear, which goes a lot in terms of numbing their pain because of concerns that they have about what's going to happen as a result of their inability to say pay their medical bills.
Mm-hmm. What about marijuana? Should it be legal for recreational use?
Yes, it absolutely should.
Okay. We got a call from Josh in Manchester. Josh, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Mr. Sanders, I just want to let you know that I work tirelessly for your dad. I was a big supporter, and I think I'm going to be a big supporter of you in the future. But I'm just wondering why you're choosing to run in CD1 when there's already at least three other progressive candidates, and I'm worried that splitting the vote amongst them might hand the election over to Maura Sullivan or Chris Pappas. Would you ever consider running for Senate and challenging some of the more conservative Democrats in office there?
First of all, thank you very much for that question. The most important thing right now is that I've lived in New Hampshire for over 15 years. My kids go to the public school system there. It was an open seat, as you're aware. I didn't even know that Carol Shea Porter was choosing not to run again. She's done a really, really great job. What I can say ultimately is that I've worked in legal services for over 17 years. I've been in a union for 23 years, and I feel that in terms of the skills that I bring to the table, as well as the folks that I work with every day, and I talk to the people in District 1, when I talk about those issues, it seems like we have a good connection, and we can talk really on a substantive level. The thought about going to Senate, let's start with the House of Representatives, and then we'll go to the United States Senate. But I really appreciate your support. And all I can say to you is that basically that I feel that in terms of my vision, my passion, I feel like I would be the best candidate.
But why not run against Representative Annie Custer in CD2? You're to the left of her. Why not pull her to the left at least?
Well, again, and Annie Custer is done a good job, and we can't be divisive right now in terms of taking on the Democratic Party. Our goal is to defeat the Republican. That's what we need to do. 2018 is an extraordinarily significant time, and I think we have a real opportunity to take back the House.
You've called for equal pay for men and women.
Yep.
How would you go about achieving this as congressman?
Well, the first question, I think it's important to understand that on average, if you guys can actually believe this, in terms of the men and women, when you deal with this, a lot of people I talked about, they don't even know this. The women on average make 79 cents to the dollar. Women are entitled to the whole dollar. In terms of how we do this, we reach out to the American public. We talk when I talk to folks in District 1, a lot of people don't even know this issue, particularly when I talk to a lot of low-income and working-class women. They don't even know this. When I talk about, talk to people, folks, about the middle class, this is something. So we need to push this envelope. I think we can bring people together. To be honest with you, this is not just a Democratic issue. This is an issue of Democrat. When I talk to folks who are Republican or undeclared, they also feel the same way. I mean, it makes logical sense. Everybody's entitled to the dollar.
Mm-hmm. In a tweet in December 2016, you responded to a Rolling Stone piece in which actress Shailene Woodley was speaking out on the Dakota Access Pipeline. She mentioned white privilege, and you responded in a tweet, quote, "Stop using this white privilege garbage. The white working class is getting crushed economically." So I want to ask you, do you think the concept of white privilege is a legitimate concept?
Yeah, first of all, let me understand. You understand that you have 140 characters in terms of a tweet. So it's important to me expand and want this
Certainly.
And understand a little bit about this scenario, right? So the reality is ultimately, I think that, you know, folks, this is dealing with the no DAPL issue in terms of the pipeline and what's going on. And I think Shailene Woodley, a lot of folks did a really, really good time. But good job. But we need to bring the American public together. We should have won that battle, and we did not win it.
Mm-hmm.
The issue ultimately in terms of what you're talking about, no, absolutely. I believe ultimately they're in terms of from an economic perspective, we need to bring folks together. I don't care whether they're black, white, expanded. Everybody is entitled to a $15 minimum wage. So that's the first issue.
Certainly. But is white privilege a thing? Is that a thing we should acknowledge and respond to in our daily discourse? In our political discourse.
Yes, let me elaborate. So you have two different. You have the economic and then you have the reality, as we know, ultimately, that if you are an African-American male or a female, you are much more apt to be pulled over by a police officer. You're much more apt to be shot. In terms of the incarceration rate, it's out of control. One out of three young black males will be in prison at one time. That is outrageous. That's unbelievable. So that's, again, I think it's important to understand the full context. And, you know, people can always jump the gun in terms of looking at a context and taken out of context, not understand the full breadth of what I said.
Well, I'm certainly happy to give you the opportunity to expand on that context. And we've covered a lot of ground in the last 16 minutes or so. But Levy Sanders, I want to thank you very much for coming on the program today and sharing your views with us.
Thank you very much.
That's Democrat Levy Sanders, one of many candidates running in CD1. And remember, you can find all of our conversations in the series Race for the First at our website, nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello, filling in today for Laura Kanoy. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.